COVID was a convenient excuse for everything. So I would be told certain materials weren't available in the province, and I would call, we would call Home Depot or Costco and say, well, maybe you need to ride around the corner because Costco's got a bunch or Home Depot has a bunch.
Welcome to the Tiny House Lifestyle Podcast, the show where you learn how to plan, build, and live the tiny lifestyle. I'm your host, Ethan Waldman, and this is episode 256 with Henry, or Hank, Beck. Hank and Mary Speck are in the process of converting their 50-acre farm back to nature as a honeybee sanctuary. And honeybees are Hank's lens for looking at the world of both investing and the world of housing. Hank is actually in the process of converting a 52-acre oceanside property into 1.5-acre lots for tiny homes. This is a broad-ranging conversation where Hank will introduce us to the concept of value investing, talk about his business model for the tiny home development, and talk about what honeybees can teach us about getting rich slowly, about value investing. I think it's a really worthwhile conversation, and I hope you'll stick around. Are you looking for a compact and affordable way to streamline your lifestyle? I'd like to tell you about the sponsor of this week's episode, PodXGo, and their new Grande S1 tiny home. This meticulously designed tiny home expands from a trailer to a 364-square-foot home with just the push of a button. Certified by NOAA and built to ANSI 119.5 standards, the Grande S1 is towable with an F-250 or equivalent. The PodXGo home is 99% factory-built with healthy and eco-friendly materials, so you can rest easy knowing your home is taking care of you and the environment. It features a fully fitted kitchen, bedroom, bath, and living room with ingenious storage spaces throughout. PodXGo has even partnered with Renogy Solar Systems so you can live off-grid or reduce your energy bills. Discover the ultimate choice for your tiny lifestyle with PodXGo's Grande S1 model. PodXGo has launched their crowdfunding campaign with special pricing starting from just $49,000. Visit podxgo.com to watch a video of the S1 unfold and to get the crowdfunding launch discount. Again, that website is PodXGo, that's PodXGo.com. Thank you so much to PodXGo for sponsoring our show. I am here with Hank Speck. In 2017, Hank and Mary Speck started converting their 50-acre farm back to nature as a honeybee sanctuary. Henry received his PhD from Michigan State University in 1988. For 30 years, he worked as a clinical psychologist in Ontario, Canada, and for 40 years as a value investor in real estate, bonds, stocks, and early-stage startups. Henry does a podcast called Invest Like a Honeybee, which can be found on most podcast platforms. 2 years ago, as part of their value investing, Henry and Mary purchased a 52-acre oceanside property that they are dividing into 1.5-acre lots for tiny homes. Currently, they have 2 tiny homes on the development that will be up and running this spring. Hank, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ethan. Great to be here.
Yeah, likewise. So first, let's start out. What is value investing? I feel like some people might not have heard that term.
Well, it's kind of basic. I'm keep things simple. So if something is being sold for $100, whether it's a pair of shoes or whatever, you have to have the ability to put a value what you think it's worth. And as long as it's worth significantly below, you know, what you think you pay what you think it's worth, not what the price is. So whether it's stocks, bonds, real estate, I'll give you an example. The land you're referring to is 52 acres oceanfront.
Yeah.
Wasn't for sale. We were able to purchase it for $300,000, which I thought was incredible value, as did my son Joshua, who now owns that company. And we were able to divide it up into lots, and each lot is worth $199,000.
Wow. Amazing.
So that would be great value. That's an example of a great value investment.
Okay. So you pay, well, you hopefully are paying less than what it's actually worth or what the market would say it's worth?
Well, everyone has a different thing of value, right? So okay. The person selling it has a number in their mind.
Yeah.
And then you as a buyer. And there's many ways to assess value. Like in the book, mm-hmm. we talk about how do you know what a pair of boots are worth?
Yeah.
What's the true value of a pair of boots? And you go through some very basic exercises, and it's mm-hmm. it's about being smart with your money and being able to mm-hmm. relax. And I okay. think that's a lot, you know, about the tiny home sort of movement. And I see it. I see tiny homes actually as a value way to live and, a legitimate asset. So that, you know, when I was your age, I'm 67. So when I was mm-hmm. younger, you know, you'd start. I talked about buying a duplex, live in half, rent out the yep. other half. I think one starter place for people who can't afford homes because they're too expensive is a tiny home. And I think we're proud to be able to provide that option for people.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is truly a great option and helps to build, you know, build wealth, have something that somebody can own rather than rent and kind of start off on the home ownership journey for sure.
And they're actually, you know, I have stayed in some, before we got into the project, Mary and I stayed in some Airbnbs that were tiny homes. And mm-hmm. you know, we're kind of lucky. Well, I feel guilty saying this. We live in kind of a big house. We had three boys. Mm-hmm. And so we live on a farm. So we have a typical, rather large farmhouse.
Yeah.
When you go live in a tiny home, even for 4 or 5 days, you realize very quickly, you don't need most of this stuff.
Right.
You have in your house, especially like we have a rooftop balcony on these tiny homes. So you can go up and you're looking out at the ocean, you know, it's kind of nice. So I think it's reconceptualizing what all of us think is good housing or adequate housing or housing, depending on where we are in life. And maybe it's a stage thing or maybe it's a forever thing. It depends on the person, I think.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think that it's a lot easier to go and stay in a tiny home, like on a trip or as like a destination, because you don't have all your stuff with you. And as you're right, you quickly realize I don't need much more space than this. It's really when it comes to all your stuff, it's like your big house is just a place for your stuff.
Well, and you know, I had some interesting discussions because in the book I talk about mm-hmm. when you're in a expensive community, move. Mm-hmm. So people in Toronto and Canada complain that an average detached house now is, I think, $1,000,000 or $800,000.
Yep.
And there are people who have houses valued at $1.5 million they paid $100,000 for. And they asked mm-hmm. me, well, what would you do? I said, well, I would sell it and I'd move to a different place where I could live for a lot less and live below my means. And which is how, you know, I think the tiny home, without really saying it, I think the tiny home movement is about doing what we did when I was young, which was a simple mm-hmm. term, live beneath your, you know, when you have $100 coming in, don't spend 150.
Right.
Spend 75. And I think the tiny home movement is a huge part of that whole value you mentioned idea of, and the thing about money is when you don't stress about it, when you don't have to think about it.
Yeah.
And I think the tiny home movement helps you do that by living economically and all the advantages of being in that space too.
Yeah, hopefully. Hopefully it does. That's the goal, at least.
There's an interesting movement in my age range where people are now looking at tiny homes with accessibility.
Yeah.
So that a person could actually, in their 70s, have a tiny home in, say, a place like we have out in Western Head, which is two hours from an international airport. And you could live in a tiny home 6 months out of the year and then live somewhere else.
Yep.
But it's now being seen more as a lifestyle option, which is kind of exciting. I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah, definitely. And that's, you know, that has surprised me. You know, I'll be 38 in a couple of weeks, but, you know, I built my tiny house 11, 12 years ago in my 20s. And I expected that would be the majority of other people building tiny houses would be younger people like me. And what I'm seeing now, since I've kind of had my hand in this world for a while now, is that it's actually more people who are retiring into tiny homes. And those are the people that are staying in the homes. Like people like me, you know, it's a starter home, maybe just for you or for you and one other person. And then as a family grows, as you have more needs, more space, you know, us young folks aren't staying in tiny homes forever. Whereas as people who are retiring tend to say, you know, this is the home that I'm going to stay in until I, you know, can't live on my own anymore.
Yeah. And I think that's a great point. And the economics of it. I mean, we were selling ours for $129,000 for the mm-hmm. home mm-hmm. and it's $500 a month for the, you know, the lot rental, which includes water and all that other stuff.
Okay.
And so we're developing these, and we even offered financing.
Yeah.
So we'll even let people, like, we have one sold and one's probably going to be sold. Yeah. We'll actually help people buy them as a starter kind of thing.
Nice.
And I think we want to build a community. So the first thing you realize when you do the project like we did is we divided the lots into 1.5 plus acre lots so that when you put a tiny home, as we have on them, we have 4 tiny homes on them, 2 on ours and 2 on the Josh runs an Airbnb out of the other one, because the surfing down there is amazing. Believe it or not, we surf in Canada primarily when it's really cold.
Yeah.
And so he rents his out when there's a surf swell coming. And all of a sudden there's all these surfers in November and December going around in the water. But the point of all that is, you know, we with COVID, I thought the theme was space. Mm-hmm. You know, you can have space. So on our 1.5 acre lots, if you want to put in a garden, if you want to have chickens, if you want to do some solar, you do whatever you want, you know, let us know ahead of time. But it's kind of like where you have that. And then when you're ready to move, you simply can move your house. Say you buy another piece of property somewhere else, you can simply move your tiny home that you own somewhere else. But we think with the ocean and you know, ocean access, where you can just walk down and jump in the ocean to surf or whatever your thing may be, it's a kind of cool lifestyle. And if you take the money you would be spending on that Toronto house, oh, by the way, we also have high-speed internet there, which was one of the cool things we wanted to make sure, even though we're in, you know, 5 or 6 minutes away from a town, which also has a hospital, which is exciting. Healthcare is there. You can actually have high speed internet. So if you work from home, it's a great spot to do that from.
Nice. And so, that's an interesting model. So you're selling the homes, but you're leasing the parking spot. And so somebody could buy the home, stay there for a year or two, and then, you know, decide to relocate and bring the home with them.
Right. We're very flexible. So we're starting to hear people say, look, I have my own tiny house or I want to build one. Can I? And we're starting to entertain that, because as long as my biggest fear was it wouldn't be aesthetically pleasing. Someone told us that we're zoned for a trailer park. We could put it, no disrespect, that's another option of housing where you put them very close together. But that's not our concept. Our concept is different, you know, a community someday. And we're fine doing a couple lots. Like, we have to develop the lots. We put in incredible water there. So every lot has their own deep well, deep sewage system, hook up to power and internet. We haven't entertained the off the grid yet, but certainly with all our land, we could have off the grid properties too. But right now we're talking about properties that have all the amenities that people can hook into.
Now, when you looked at this property, did you look at it with an eye towards doing a tiny house development, or did you kind of buy the property and then kind of come to tiny houses? Oh, this would be a great spot to do tiny houses.
Had no idea. So when we be quite up honest with you, we bought these properties because when Biden got elected and our guy was talking about carbon offsets, I said to our team, and then now Joshua owns that company, so let's go out and get as much land as we can close to ocean or on ocean, high-speed internet, paved roads, that we can just land bank. Let's just keep it for the next generation. Who cares? It'll be trees. It's good feeling, all that kind of stuff. So Joshua, our son, who's a surfer, went and looked at Western Head, where we had accumulated 150-some acres, and said, Dad, this is a great place. We should do X, Y, and Z. So I said, let's do it. So we started with the tiny home, and we're continually evolving. He's on Airbnb. So if people want to check it out, you can go to Ocean Top Tiny Homes, surf Western Head. And check it out on Airbnb. But we, Mary and I, have a piece of property that we're doing the project. But the project is flexible based on what people need. As long as it's a legit tiny home, you can build one, you can bring one in. We'll prepare the lot for you. We're only going to do a couple lots a year. We're very slow. We want to see how it goes.
Yeah.
But it's a very quiet, cool place to be, because you've got the ocean, about a 180-degree view of the ocean, and behind you have trees everywhere, so you're somewhat isolated, but it's 7 or 8 minutes from town, so you have all the other amenities that you need.
Yeah, it's the photos that you sent, you know, it looks like a beautiful setting, and we'll post those up on the show notes page for this episode. I'm curious to learn more about the tiny houses that you're building. Are they all like a fixed design, or are you kind of doing, you know, each one at a time, unique? How is that working?
We did 4 of the same, because we started with a builder who was building them, and I wanted high ceilings.
Yep.
We have 11-foot ceilings, and also wanted a first floor bedroom.
Yep.
And I had to have a bathroom that was a real bathroom.
Okay.
I didn't want to have a shower where you're showering with the toilet, which I think is a concept depending on the site. So we actually have a separate shower with a shower door and a separate place and all of that kind of stuff. And so I wanted, those are my only two. So we put that into the design and the rooftop balcony because of the views, and also a wood stove so that we could have a tiny wood stove in there because we have wood everywhere as a backup. We were entertaining solar. We have solar on many of our properties, but we didn't do solar on these yet. We're still sort of fooling around with that idea for battery backup or actual off-grid living. So, you know, it just sort of working with the builder. Now, the trouble, as you may know, is that I've learned, and this is, I don't know very much about it, obviously, but there's a group like yourself who build, who are very handy. I have no skills. I can't build anything. And then there's a group of contractors who really are or aren't in the business. So there's a group that are really building incredibly high-end tiny homes.
Yeah.
But there isn't a group that are building nice, affordable, you know, solid homes. Our guy did, but he's now into other building because the construction industry went so crazy. He went into other bigger projects. So currently, we don't have a tiny home builder. We're looking at different options. And we're also hearing from people who have interest in our land. They'd like to bring their own home or build their own. So I think that's where we'll probably end up. We're not going to be building them anymore. We're going to be providing the great space and the infrastructure. You know, I have a man who does the road in case it snows. And make sure, you know, folks enjoy where they're at.
Yeah. Well, that's really exciting. And what are the laws like there? You know, are they friendly to tiny homes?
Well, see, that's a great question because most municipalities in Canada and Nova Scotia have passed laws saying you can have a home with your existing house because of the housing crisis. Many of them, however, still have not built up the infrastructure and the bylaws to allow tiny homes, but they allow them.
Okay.
So before we could do our tiny homes project, we had to put in a development plan, which we did, and it was approved, and it clearly indicated they were tiny homes. But then the provincial bylaws are somewhat in conflict to the local bylaws. So we've had no issues, and they recently hit us with some taxes, so they're happy with it.
There you go.
But we're going to have to see what ends up happening. I think there's a strong movement to make sure these homes are allowed because they're incredible. Like we have central air. I guess you don't call it central air conditioning, but they're air conditioned, they're heated, they have all the amenities, they're safe. So yeah, I think they're here to see. I mean, I think of people living in mobile homes who drive around the country, and that's the other concept. We're not sure if the populations are compatible, but we could easily have these 1.5 acre lots for mobile home folks too, to park their trucks for a while they enjoy surfing or whatever they're doing. So we're still sort of toying. We don't want to disrupt it for the other people, but we're trying to find the right mix.
Yeah. You could always have a balance, a blend, you know, maybe a couple of spots that are available for, you know, people who are traveling, not just mobile homes. You know, there's like a whole van life, schoolies, you know, converted vehicles that people live in and travel in.
Ethan, what's the off the grid group like? Is there a lot of people who want off the grid living, or do people want all the amenities as we're thinking of providing?
I think that it's a little bit of everything. I think that a lot of tiny home owners end up being off the grid more because they have to, just because of where they're parking, might not have a power hookup. So, there are some people who go into it specifically because they want to be off the grid, but I would say the majority want to be connected and want it to be convenient and stable and reliable versus, you know, waking up and, you know, not having enough battery power to make your toast.
Yeah, I understand. I feel good about, I mean, we're going to continue with the development that way.
Yeah.
You know, bringing in the power was a challenge. I mean, I didn't know. Just bringing in the hydro from the road took us probably 4 months of talking to groups and the power company and all kinds of things. So getting the infrastructure, you know, sometimes it sounds simple. We'll just buy a piece of land and, you know, do this and that, or the septics, you know, making sure the wells are properly tested and you have all the, you know, filters in place. And, you know, it is, but, you know, on the other side, it's wonderful to see that we might be, when we finish the project, we'll have about 25 lots on the one property.
Okay.
It'd be kind of cool to have 25, you know, tiny home owners there. And then we might actually put, we were talking about putting a little office up somewhere so people could use like a,
yeah,
you know, just to get into an office share situation to get out of the house for a bit.
A central space or building. Yeah.
Right.
That's the dream for many people, I think, being able to live in community and have, you know, a shared space that can serve needs that the little house, you know, can't quite do, like for bigger gatherings or office space, that kind of stuff.
Well, the good news too, is we have the ocean. So you can, in 5 minute walk, you can get down to the ocean. And so you can sit just by the ocean and enjoy, you know, everything it has to offer. So that's pretty exciting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it sounds like you're doing it right. It sounds expensive. Do you mind if I ask what your, you know, cost per lot to develop is?
Well, that's a great question. I can tell you that the septics and the water are in that $30,000 to $40,000 range.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you get all your approvals and everything done, then you have the infrastructure of the road building. So you have to build a solid road and you know make it with gravel and so on.
Yeah.
On top of that, you have engineering and surveying costs.
Yeah.
So you know, in the province, it's quite good. Everything is approved by standards of health. So we had to dig for the soil content to put in the septics properly. And because we're such a spread out community, we're not doing high intense stuff. We're doing pretty much, you know, 1.5 acres is quite a large property. So I would say probably to develop without the cost of the land, just simply developing, we're probably looking at that $40,000 to $50,000 a lot range.
Okay.
To develop.
All right. Not terrible.
No, and we're lucky because we have a great road. Philip, our road guy down there, is really reasonable. He has his own gravel pit,
nice
rock crushing operation. So we've developed a relationship, and he's worked with us. Over the last 2.5 years, we've been working on the project. So
yeah,
local. Try to hire local whenever we can. We have a great electrician who's local.
Of course,
he helps with the power negotiation stuff. So yeah, it's a lot of fun, you know. It's become a challenge, but it's a great learning opportunity. And I think it's to help people who are at either the starter side or the other side, and they haven't had a lot of real estate experience, because negotiation's everything, as you probably know, and trying to get the right situation and value is important for people.
What has been, you know, what's been the biggest challenge, or what have been some of the biggest challenges so far?
I think getting, you know, we built during COVID other properties, standing properties, rentals, student properties at university towns. This the building was the most challenging, because some of the I've dealt with contractors for 40 years and it's a tough industry. Some say the worst industry on the planet. And so COVID was a convenient excuse for everything.
Okay.
And so, you know, we would hear, and we've never had delay in my 40 years of doing things. This is the first time. And we were building houses during COVID that were on time and on budget, by the way.
Yeah. Okay.
So I would be told certain materials weren't available in the province, and we would call Home Depot or Costco and say, well, maybe you need to ride around the corner because Costco's got a bunch or Home Depot has a bunch. Yeah. And so I think it came down to the contracting, the building part. The land part was just amazing, going down there and talking to because he loved his work and he was upfront, transparent, honest. And you just really appreciate that in when you're working with anybody in the building trades.
Yeah.
But I have a statement, you know, I think that the problem is that with what happened with building, and no disrespect to builders, but many builders felt like they were neuroscientists.
Mm-hmm.
And they could charge you whatever they wanted, and they would try to, like, we only do fixed price quotes.
Okay.
So if we're going to build something for $100,000, it's $100,000. That's it. There's no upselling. There's no, I'm not going to make any changes to the design. That's what the price is.
Right.
And so despite those contracts, people continually would try to change things. And we'd say, that's not happening.
Right.
You know, and so when you have to get to the point of getting lawyers involved to get a project completed without actually having to do the very painful litigation piece.
Yeah.
But you have to be prepared to stand by what you both do. I mean, to me, a handshake's everything. When you shake someone's hand and they agree and then later they tell you, well, you know, I have a problem with that. So I think finding a reputable builder in the future is going to be a problem, which is perhaps why in your case, building it yourself is great, because you control all those things.
Right.
you probably know right now lumber's dropped, what, 70% of where it was a year and a half ago.
Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah, and I was told at the time, oh, lumber's never going to drop. You know, or someone, we were going to build, I'll tell you this one very quickly. We were going to build a small 800 square foot, two bedroom on the ocean front. And the cost for just the cement, which normally would be $3,000 to $5,000 to get it poured and done as a slab, was $18,000.
Oh my gosh.
I said, that's not happening. What planet are, where, you talk about value. See, you have to know, I think, the value of things. And to me, that was probably the most painful. And it was disrespectful. Because now the same people would be happy to have the work at a reasonable price, but they're not going to get it because you never forget those things. The gouging that went on during, and I'm sure it's still going on today for some excuse, but the COVID excuse and the supply chain problems was, people memorized that even though it wasn't true.
So how do you know what the value of something is? I mean, I'll give an example of, you know, somebody listening who really wants to live in a tiny house, you know, can't build it themselves or don't want to build it themselves for some reason. And, you know, they're getting quotes from builders that seem really high. Like how do you figure out what the value of something is?
Well, I'm fortunate in that in 40 years, I have a few people that I can trust to give me the real answer. So because I don't know a lot about building, although I do know numbers and costs, I'll call one contractor I know. And he would say to me, because I said to him, let's start a tiny home building company. It's so bad. Yeah. What should we be able to build them for? He said, well, you could build them for a reasonable profit for about $35,000 to $40,000. I said, really? Wow.
That seems low to me. Yeah.
How come there people are quoting 150?
Yeah.
And then so there's that. Then there's, as I talk about in the book, how do you tell the value of a pair of boots?
Yeah.
You have to drill. You don't have to know a lot about building, but you have to drill down. What are they going to charge me for the lumber per square foot? What are they charging me for the trailer if it's going to be on wheels? How does it relate? Like, what's the cost per square foot? If it's a 200 square foot home and you want $100,000, that's $500 a square foot.
Mm-hmm.
That's extremely expensive.
Right.
$500. So you start to develop. Part of it's my experience. Part of it is ask a lot of questions. And part of it is a sense of the person I'm dealing with. And I have another colleague I've worked with 30 years. And this is what happens over time. You quickly weed out those contractors who aren't straight up. They might do a one-off with you. But when you find a group that you can work with, in our case, we always provide work for them. They're the first call-up. It doesn't matter. And we do a fair price, even though maybe we could get it for a bit less. We pay a bit more because we want to keep them in business and we have a great relationship. Right. And they're honest. And they're all fixed price. There's no extra.
Yeah. Yeah. So they come up with a bid based on what they think it's going to cost. And then that's the price you agree on.
Well, we negotiate. So with the contractors we work with, it's not unusual for us to say, well, that's not going to work. And if it can't work, we won't do the project. So we're never married to a project. It's like the worst thing you can do in investing is being so emotionally connected to it that you want it so bad that you'll pay whatever, and they can sense that. And it's very much what we've learned from the honeybees. The honeybees do everything based on rules.
Okay.
There's no emotion. So you, as a buyer of a tiny home, need to know what you should pay in your community based on the quality of what you want to have built.
Yep.
And if no one will do it for that, don't build it. We walked away from three construction projects a year ago because the prices quoted were absolutely insane. And they all said, oh, you'll be paying more next. I said, well, maybe I just will never build this.
Yeah.
And sure enough, now prices have dropped incredibly. And now people are calling us for work. A year ago, I'd be calling around contracts. Oh, I have no time to quote. I'm so busy. I have no time. Now they're calling us up, or they're saying, when you call up to get some construction work done, they'll say, I can pencil you in 3 days. How does that look?
Yeah.
And a year ago, it was a year, right? Oh, six months. Oh, we're so backed up. Yep. And you go, okay.
Interesting.
And that's the point I think I want to make to some of your listeners. Don't be in a hurry. Go ahead and wait and bring someone around who understands pricing with you. Have it reviewed. Mm-hmm. Get three quotes.
Yep.
And always say, I always ask people, how did you come up with that number?
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. We bought an incredible ocean house, my wife and I, that was empty for 7 years other than rodents. No yep. one lived in this house, right?
Yep.
So we were getting quotes for things. So the quotes to paint the outside of this beautiful home on the ocean ranged from 12 to 28,000. The same paint, the same square footage.
Right.
So I'd say to these people, how did you get 28? Well, that's what it is. I said, well, but could you break it down?
Yeah.
No, that's what I said. Well, that's not what it is because I'm not paying you that. So you want to make sure you get a number of different quotes and, you know, and treat people with respect. I respect contractors because I can't do anything they do. I respect incredible skill, incredible abilities.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean we're not going to come up with a fair sort of exchange of services for money.
Definitely. So let's talk honeybees. I will admit that my wife and I are I guess I'm going to say we were amateur beekeepers. We
wonderful.
Bees for a few years at our tiny house when it was in a different location. We don't currently have bees, but what can honeybees teach us about value investing and about tiny homes?
Well, again, it was very randomly discovered, and I've been working in investing for 40 years, and we're converting our farm back to nature. So we're around bees and around nature and how you take a 50-acre, you know, really incredible cash crop land and turn it into back to nature.
Okay.
And so we watched our bees, and at the same time, I was reading Benjamin Graham, Warren Buffett, all that kind of stuff. And you started looking at it, and you go, the bees have really good rules about investing. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a couple quick examples. The honeybees can tell you, they tell each other every 15 minutes, the status of the queen, as you may know. So there's 40,000 bees in a hive. Every 15 minutes, they all know how they're doing, okay?
Okay.
Now think about our own financial world. Do we know, forget every 15 minutes, do we know every week how we're doing financially? Mm-hmm. Our credit card, our bank, what we're spending, what we're earning. So getting a real good assessment of right now is incredibly important.
Yep.
Another one is probability. Bees have a probability in mind when it comes to deciding on where to live. So when they swarm, they go out, send scouts, come back. They have to hit around 75% to go ahead and move into that house. They have to agree. Mm-hmm. 75% of the scouts have to say, yeah, that's a place I want to live. And then the hive says, okay, let's go. So there's a probability of success. But even with that, only about 30% of the hives make it till the next spring. So when you invest and you're a value investor, you have to realize there's a probability to failure all the time. Mm-hmm. So with the honeybees, it's survival. So we as humans need to look at how we can survive. So in that tiny home property purchase example, I said to myself, what's the probability I'm not going to get that money back someday, the $300,000 that we spent for the 52 oceanfront acres? I think that the chances are pretty good we'll at least break even.
Yeah.
Forget how much you make. Just break even with inflation. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we don't think about that when we're investing. And the big one too, honeybees are value investors. So they'll go out to a clover flower ahead of another flower because the sugar value of the clover in the nectar is much higher.
Yep.
And their value. So they get more for their effort or more for their money.
Yeah.
Take it back to the hive, and it's easier to make honey out of that type of nectar. And so they're value investors, just like you may look for a value property, or I may. Something that you can take and use and get more out of it than another product, which is another definition of value. So there's 10 lessons in that book. I wrote it for our grandchildren. We have three wonderful grandchildren. And you know, when you know stuff, your kids don't listen and your grandchildren don't listen. So this way the honeybees are kind of telling everybody, this is how to become a value investor and be smart with your money, because then you don't have to think about it. You can pursue things based on other reasons other than money. And that's pretty exciting.
That is very exciting. Yeah. I was always amazed to learn that how far the bees would travel from the hive, you know, to get specific nutrients or to go to specific flowers at different times of year.
And they always calculate it. They always know that the amount of energy I expend isn't equal or greater than what I'm going to get.
Right.
Because that's where they cut it off, which is genius.
Right.
We often don't think that way, right? So if we thought the same way, then we would get more value for what we're doing based on that. And so
in
our 50 acres, we've created like a honeybee heaven, right? So we've got ponds for water. We have clover to fill up their gas tanks. We have wildflowers. We have trees everywhere. So they get the early maples and willows. And now we're integrated with Tallgrass Prairie we planted that was original to this land hundreds of years ago. And I have to tell you, it's pretty exciting. We were walking out just yesterday and we brought in different genetics. So we brought in bees from Saskatchewan where it's like minus 40 in the winter. They were out flying yesterday. It was 5 degrees Celsius. I'm thinking, I'm cold. What are, what are these bees doing? So we're trying to realize the microclimate that we're creating. Remember, all around us is some of the incredible agricultural land in the country. So they're using Roundup and all this crazy spray stuff that we used to use. And the question is, can you create an oasis in the middle of all this advanced farming? And I think you can. One quick one, I'll tell you if you got a second. We discovered that infrared light attracts bees at night. So we have a 24/7 webcam at wildflowerbeefarm.com. You can watch the bees. It's all free. And we noticed that sometimes at night there'd be a big ball of bees out outside of the hive. And it's not because it's too warm. They weren't, it was just right in front of the camera. So I did some research and I found out that years ago, they took bees that were dipped in neonicotinoid poison and treated them with infrared light. And they not only recovered, but they thrived. So I talked to my electrician. I said, hey, buddy, what's in that camera? He goes, well, that's infrared. So this year on some of our border colonies, we're going to install infrared solar powered lights at the entrance so that we're going to try to figure out, can we counteract any possible spray effects on bees with this infrared inexpensive solution where you have a solar panel powering a light at night? And if they start coming out like they were doing here, the bees get it, right? And I have to tell you, the hive that is on the light here where you can watch on the farm is one of the healthiest hives I've ever seen.
Wow.
And it might just be random. It's only one. But the science in the laboratory would tell us that we can counteract the agricultural movement with all these neonicotinoids and crazy sprays they use by just helping them a little bit. And that's what servant beekeeping. I'm not sure what type you practice, but servant really means you do the least amount possible, but you still try to help them.
Yeah, I think, you know, we were so new to it that we were just trying to figure it out, but we didn't do any like heavy chemical treatments or anything like that. We were trying to do, you know, the integrated pest management. Is that that's a thing? Yeah, I'm searching back in my memory now.
What did you use for mites? Can I ask? Do you use Thymol or Formic Pro or
Formic acid, some product that had formic acid in it. Yeah.
So what we've done is we have a few of those because we're testing them out. It doesn't seem to be any difference whether we treat or not.
Okay.
And our bees are starting, and many of these bees, Saskatraz particularly, will carry out sick babies and will chew the legs off mites. If you let honey, if you can feel the pain of losing hives as we have had to do. Eventually, the bees do adapt if we leave them alone. The problem is, it's so hard to leave them alone, right? I mean, you want to help them. You want to give them. I was out, I lifted a hive the other day. The bees were flying. I thought, this is a light hive. I should add some honey. And then I said, no, it's not my job. I'm going to stay. I'm going to get out of the way. Let nature take its course. So, servant beekeeping is very much watching and listening. And not like, I'll give you an example. When I trained to be a beekeeper some years ago, you open the hive every 2 weeks to see how they're doing.
Yeah.
Well, every time you open a hive, you break the seal, the propolis. It'd be like someone taking a roof off your house when you make chocolate chip cookies and then putting the roof back on and the smells are different.
Yeah.
The energy to seal it is stressful. So we're trying to only enter them once, maybe a year or twice if you're going to split them because we still split to try to find the right genetics. But I think there's a good balance you can do without having to, you know, bomb your bees with spray or pesticides every 2 weeks.
Yeah, definitely. And we were always like two, I think we had three hives at one point. And so it was like, we knew here in Vermont, you know, it's a very long winter. The spring tends to be really hard for them because they're running out of food and there's not much happening outside in terms of flowers and nectar. But, you know, we know that if you have more hives, you know, you're going to lose some, but you're also going to, some are going to make it. And then you kind of can build from there.
One of the challenges, as you say, is habitat, right? When you look at where are they going to go? Like around here, if it wasn't for our 50 acres, all of the land is farmed. There aren't even, there used to be headlines, right? Where you'd have like 20 feet wide and the length of the farm would be grass and trees. That's all taken out now for efficiency. And many of these farms are thousands of acres. So there is not, I took a drive from our place to Niagara Falls, which is about a 3-hour drive, could not find any natural habitat along the highway. Nothing. It's cut or sprayed. There's no place for those bees. There's the odd forest you'll find. So I think habitat's 95% of our problem. I really do.
Yeah.
Our goal, our dream is for every 100 acres, there's 1 acre of oasis for bees and wildlife. I mean, we have, I don't know how many, the first year we stopped farming this property, before we planted the wildflowers, we had 95 different wildflowers on the farm.
Wow.
So for 100 acres, it was sprayed to death. We stopped for 1 year, and all of a sudden there's 95, and that's reassuring to me. That was really exciting. I thought, yeah, man, we're, nature, and I had one of those apps, back. You know, where you can take a pic.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And now we're getting, this is really crazy. I don't understand. Now we're getting things that happen that bees like. Balsam trees. We don't plant them. We don't have any balsam trees around here. And of course, bees use that for propolis, right? Different types of trees. Why would a tree that bees use for propolis suddenly start popping up on our farm? Bees don't carry seeds. How did that happen?
I don't have an answer. Do you have an answer?
No idea. I don't know anything. Yeah. I mean, the more you study nature and bees, we know maybe 5%. I mean, we don't know anything about bees, you know. I mean, we think we do, but we don't.
Right. When you're keeping bees and you think that you know what they're supposed to be doing, it turns out that the bees didn't read the same book that you did.
Well, the takeover, you know, the takeover kills me. You know, the takeover, usurpation or whatever they call it. A hive can go into another hive in 10 minutes, take it over.
Yeah.
So a beekeeper, what they call a master beekeeper, a genius beekeeper, could go to the bathroom, come back, look at his hive and say, boy, this hive's healthy. But it's a whole different hive than when he went to the bathroom. But they don't know. We don't know, right? Yeah. We have no idea.
So you have a podcast called Invest Like a Honeybee. Tell us about the show and what kind of stuff do you talk about?
Sure. It used to be called Shrink Money Advice when I was a psychologist. Okay.
Money Advice.
Which is it's a dumb title, but it's really about, I interview guests who are into, but I also talk about smart money, being smart with your money. And it's kind of common sense, but the push, and I'm not sure, we haven't talked finance, the push is really to get people to react based on information, not emotion. Because when you watch the shows every morning on business, they try to get you hyped up, buy this, sell that, Google, Amazon, you know, none of that. No, base it on value and have a plan like the bees. And then none of this matters. Interest rates don't matter. Inflation doesn't. You know, you think about right now, back to that lesson, what's happening right now? Most people can't tell you. And as far as predicting the future, no idea. And people who tell you they can, think of the bees again. 75% think they're picking a great house, and 30% of the time are they right out of that group. We have no idea. It can take one event and all of a sudden. So when you know, when we land banked, the idea of land for me where the tiny homes are was to have a place where you feel you can sleep at night because you always have the land, the trees, you know, you're close to the water. You can fish if you had to eat protein. I suppose you could hunt some rabbits or something, but you have this place where you feel secure. So I think as people, we need to find out what makes us secure, because once you're secure, you can take on all those other things that you care about.
Nice. Well, I'm looking forward to checking it out. It sounds, I mean, both titles actually sound interesting. I would listen to Shrinking Money too, but I'm going to listen to Invest Like a Honeybee.
Well, I wrote Shrink Honey Advice for My Children because, as you know, as I said, you can't give a relative or a friend advice. So I thought if I write this book, I think one of my sons edited it and I made the other son edit it. And then I didn't care if I sold any because they were, now this book we wrote for, and by the way, I also listened to my advice in Shrink Money Advice. It's a parody of a couple who aren't happy with their life and how they end up. And anybody who followed that information, multimillionaire now, just luck. Shrink, what grandpa learned from his honeybees, we wrote for our grandchildren for the same reason. So that when they're 9, 10, or an adult reads it who's not feeling good about their money, they can actually learn some basic lessons to get them to that next step. And in the appendix of that book, I actually put in two stocks that I only own three or four stocks now, I think it is.
Uh-huh.
How do I find value in those stocks? And if you so you can take it from the very basic honeybee story. And if you want to get a calculator out, you can actually push it all the way to analyzing stocks. But we wrote it actually for young children and young people who haven't had a lot of financial experience.
Awesome. Well, the books both sound great. So where can people get the books?
So you can get What Grandpa Learned from His Honeybees just came out a couple of weeks ago on Amazon. I think Audible is going to be this week.
Nice.
I think the hardcover's today. So if you want to get Kindle or the soft cover, you can get it now. But Audible's probably within a week.
Okay.
Yeah, and I encourage grandparents to read it to children. Maybe you do one bee story a day. The worst case scenario is you'll learn 10 things about bees, 10 different bee stories.
Yeah.
And then we apply those to being smart with your money, which, you know what? If you're smart with your money, it's a lot easier to not have to just zone out of all that money stuff. You don't even have to think about it. Get a system in place that you have confidence in, that you trust, and then you don't have to worry. And when you get enough money, then you can look at investing in a certain way and just sort of make yourself feel comfortable. Because in the end, you know, you want to be able to practice or do whatever you do to take care of the planet in a better way. And one way is you need some resources, and this will help you with that, like the honeybees do. It's crazy.
Awesome. And so they're both on Amazon then?
Yeah, you can get them on Amazon. Shrink Money Advice, I wrote a while ago and did an update edition. And that actually, most of that, I even have a list of strategies. If I was starting out today, what would I do? How would I take on high house prices? Well, how would I invest? And so but it's very simple. And it's based on my 40 years, and the stuff kind of works. I'm not a financial planner, so I tell people, make sure you check it out with your financial people before you start making all these changes. But no vested interest in this. You're not buying stocks that I care about or whatever. It's more about giving you sort of some ideas. And in What Grandpa Learned from the Honeybees, I have 13 books in the appendix that I think you should read. So if you want to go beyond the basic and really dive in, I read tons of books on finance. Those are my 13 favorite that I think really have changed my life when it comes to investing.
Fantastic. And actually, that's a great segue, because I always like to ask guests what are two or three favorite books or resources that have helped them out. So maybe could you give us a preview of one or two of those books?
You know, I just read this when I was finishing the book. And again, you know how you get that sort of spiny, tingly up your spine? I was reading... Pabri's book on Don Doe investing, Don Doe. It's in there, and it's about an Indian family. They come from India with basically no money, and they end up owning 50% of the motels in America.
Wow!
So how does a family with barely any money, and when I was reading this, I'm going, okay, that's B lesson 10, that's B lesson 6. I couldn't believe this book, how it just intersected with what we were, and at the time we were editing the book, What Grandpa Learned from His Honeybees. And this book was so powerful. The family, how they ended up owning, and to this day, 50% of all the motels in America.
Wow.
And they started with one little one in a lousy little community that nobody wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's lessons in the book about risk. And the risk is a really important one. Hard work, work ethic, because that's one of the other things we talk about. How do you work on the right things when you have to? But really work.
Yeah.
Like when you're looking at a project or an investment, I'm sure when you're building your tiny home, you were probably a bit obsessed about that home, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe your partners weren't too happy around you, but that becomes really what you do. And that's outstanding. And it's that obsession that you have when you're doing investing or other things that will take you to that level. And the other thing I should say, the good thing about Pabri's book on I think it's Dondro or Dandro investing, you'll get it in the appendix, is that you take responsibility. I don't like to see people taken advantage of. And so when you're asking for financial advice, most people check out a mechanic more than they'll check out the person they're going to give all their money to invest. And I really want people to be responsible. Say, wait a minute. It's like that contractor who says it's going to cost you $28,000 to paint the outside of a house instead of the $12,000 you got it done for.
Yeah.
You know, what questions are you going to ask? Or the crypto thing, you know, this recent fraud issue. When you look at that from the outset, you say to yourself, what was this? What were you doing? And you think of many people have read about Madoff and the sophisticated people that went down with Madoff, and now with this other investor, not investor, this young guy in the Bahamas, the crypto guy. They didn't do their due diligence. They had no rules. They piled in because it felt good, or it looked good, or it was, they got in the emotional thing. Oh, you know, crypto's going to be worth $1 million, Bitcoin, because there's only so many. But is that really? How sure are you to get your money back if you do this deal? And so if we had some of those B lessons, most people would not have thrown away their life earnings on Madoff or crypto. I mean, there's something about having rules that you feel comfortable with when it comes to your money. And I think it's a responsibility. We teach children to wash their hands, particularly now with Norwalk virus and all that. We wash your hands after you go to the.
Yeah.
We don't teach them financial rules. I don't know why. You know, spend less than you make. Credit card debt is a bad thing.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not, you don't need a PhD. Yeah. Figure out this stuff. But for some reason, emotion takes over, right, Ethan? And then we forget about all that. The common sense is out the window.
Right.
I heard Kevin O'Leary the other day. He's Canadian. We'd like to permanently have him go to America now, though, because he said he would still invest in the crypto guy even when they were hauling him off to jail.
Yeah.
Like, what is that? How can you ever trust anything he says again?
Right, right. I don't wade too far into that stuff on this podcast, but I'm on the same page as you in regard to all that, you know, the crypto stuff.
You know, and I someone said to me the other day, well, actually, I remember when I was a lot younger than you, a man sat me down and said, how much money would you like to have someday? I said, $30,000 a year would be about right. I could live on $30,000 a year. He says, no, you can't. That's stupid. And no, I was living on $30,000 with three kids. And right now, you know what, Ethan? I can live on $30,000 a year.
Wow.
I cook. Nice. I do stuff. Yeah. We have I buy cars that are used. I don't, you know, like my Volkswagens cost $18,000. I buy them 2 years off the lot and they last 10 or 15 years. I don't. Yeah. So I'm a simple guy. Look at, I don't even have a clothing allowance that I care about. So the point of all that is it's taking control, and it doesn't mean you have to do that.
Right.
But, it, or other people, it just means do what makes you feel comfortable so that you live within your means, which is what the Beast teaches.
Nice. Well, Hank Speck, thank you so much for being a guest on the show. This was a really fun conversation, and I think there's something in it for many listeners.
It was a blast. Thanks for having me, Ethan. Take care.
Thank you so much to Hank Speck for being a guest on the show today. You can find the show notes, including a complete transcript and links to Hank's podcast, at thetinyhouse.net/256. Again, that's thetinyhouse.net/256. Thank you so much to PodXGo for sponsoring the show today. You can find out more about the Grande S1 Tiny House over at podxgo.com. Again, that's podxgo.com. Well, that's all for this week. I'm your host, Ethan Waldman, and I'll be back next week with another episode of the Tiny House Lifestyle Podcast.